Hey there, my name's Oisin Dunne and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, I am delighted to catch up with my old friend Andy Robinson, and we're going to have a chat about the business landscape for independent artists and have a look at how innovative business models are putting creators first. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Great to see you. So listen, we are actually having this podcast recording face-to-face, IRL, in the real world, my goodness, which is a real treat, and our surroundings are magnificent. Now, Andy, talk to us a bit about Interstellar Studios. We're just outside Barcelona, and maybe describe for our listeners exactly what is sitting around us here. We've got musical instruments, we've got musical things. Take us through this room.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to keep my musical things upstairs, so they're all down here. But in case anyone that visits wasn't aware, I'm a big fan of music, both playing and listening to it. So
sweet. Okay, and just to take you through a little 360 here, we've got a Ludwig drum kit. There's a Fender Telecaster on the wall. There's some massive old school speakers. There's tons of vinyl, thousands of vinyl records. We are in the presence of a real one, a real music lover. It's great to be here in this space where all your music stuff has been banished to in the house. Congratulations, it's a good space. So listen, let's kind of start at the beginning. Just, I think it's instructive for our listeners to get your take on what it means to be an independent artist in 2024, because we're kind of a world away from, you know, what we would have thought of as an indie artist on the cover of the Enemy back in the 80s. You know, what's an indie artist in 2024?
Yeah, I think it's quite a wide range of people these days. And sort of, as you say, it traditionally used to be that people that were signed to independent record labels rather than major record labels. But now, you know, the democratization of music production means that there's a lot of people making music and releasing music. And there's all sorts of DIY services for doing that. And, you know, both the releasing and then claiming the royalties on the other side of that. My definition, I think, of independent artists is, you have the hobbyists, of course, and you know, even they, without the intention of creating some valuable piece of copyright, can do that. So you've got people that are sort of outgrowing DIY services, and then you've also got people who are coming out of what would be traditionally classed as sort of major deals, and their rights are reverting, and then they're in a position where they've got to look at like what's next for me and my career and my catalogue.
Nice. So independent artists are folks on the way up and they are kind of breaking out of the hobbyist and prosumer market, but it's also folks who've been around for many years and they just find themselves in control of their own back catalogue and they're looking to do something cool with it. Okay, brilliant. Thank you. And, you know, what actually brought you to this space where you are helping these independent artists that you're describing with this new approach to business?
Well, I mean, you're sat in the evidence of it, to be honest, which is that, you know, on the left-hand side of the room is my failed career as a musician. On the right-hand side of the room is my sort of abandoned career as a DJ. And yeah, I mean, so my background is that essentially I was in a band that no one's ever heard of, and that's a good thing, and that I've come to terms with it, it's fine. I then was a DJ for a long time, and I always sort of joke that I peaked at low mid-level. I played all the right festivals, but all the wrong stages. But then I realized that while I was sort of in that world, I was surrounded by very, very talented people, and that really they were much more talented than me on the creative side. And so I realized that my journey was probably to be sort of supporting and empowering artists rather than trying to be one myself. And I'm very happy with that decision because it's been incredibly rewarding. But I started off as a manager. I was a manager for just over 10 years. And then I've also set up record labels and publishing companies and various other sort of rights thing, and really sort of tried to make sense and understand the landscape around an independent artist. And my focus these days is on trying to empower those artists and give them the best possible opportunities without the exploitative nature of some of the music industry.
Yes. Okay. We'll be diving into that for sure. And I like the fact that you've actually, you know, you've walked the walk and you've done the things that now you help other people do and other people succeed at in terms of innovative business models. So you're kind of putting together the music business that maybe you would have liked to have seen as an artist, as a DJ, as somebody who's, you know, working with management. So talk to us a bit about some of the new business models that you are observing on the landscape and that also you're working with? Because to be indie in 2024 means something different to be indie in 1984.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a big subject, so I'll sort of hone in, I think, on just a couple of elements here for your audience. But one thing is about the right side of stuff. Do you need a record label? Been a question for a long, long time. And what an actual, you know, record label actually does has changed a lot over that period of time as well. The traditional deal, whether it be major or independent, was always a sort of long-term ownership of rights. Sometimes with rights reversions, mostly on the independent side, or, you know, traditionally independent side. But it's always been about creative control, and essentially you're signing away your future. And me personally, you know, back in 2016, I launched Interstellar Publishing with a guy called Alan Jacobs, who was previously at EMI Publishing. And the business model, which, you know, was brought from him, was essentially this idea that we don't need to take long-term ownership. Actually, we could just manage the rights on behalf of the owners and do a good job. And those people will stay with us if we don't exploit them and we look after them and we do a good job. And that's always really resonated with me, that idea that you facilitate and empower rather than land grab rights. So that's one option, one element of it. And I think, you know, another thing that I think is really front of mind for me at the moment is about management, artist management, because as an ex-manager and then looking at things, talking to a lot of managers over the last couple of years on the rights side of stuff, you realize that there is an inherent issue with the model or the traditional model of artist management, where essentially the artist manager maybe has a contract, a written contract, maybe has a verbal contract, you know, really doesn't have any security over their future and what they're going to get paid. And it used to be that you would manage an artist, sign the artist to a record label and publishing company, take a large advance, take your percentage of that, and that's what you would all survive off of. But now the power really is in artists and writers owning their rights and keeping long-term control. But there seems to be this issue where, of course, you know, if a manager isn't sure they're still going to be working with that artist down the line, then they're incentivized to get the bag, as they would say, as quickly as possible, yes, rather than necessarily doing a long-term approach.
Mm.
For me personally, I'm actually just about to launch something under the Interstellar Management, InterstellarMGMT.com, sorry for the plug, which is essentially a pay-by-the-hour management,
wow,
service. So essentially, you can give advice that is unencumbered by these incentives and just basically, you know, the best advice because you're being paid by the hour to give that advice. So that is my sort of direction of travel, is not trying to get people locked into long-term things and just try to, you know, give information, give support, give power back to the artist.
That is so revolutionary. I mean, I've never heard of that before, and I've been around the block a few times. This is not my first rodeo, but the nature of music management contracts, historically, like you say, it's been to lock in, to get as much as possible, you know, and to kind of have peaks of income, like a record advance, a publishing advance, etc. And it's all about getting a cut of the advance and a cut of the royalties. But what you're talking about is that doesn't actually serve the artist in the long run. And, you know, the kind of pay by the hour model, I think, is utterly fascinating. So we will absolutely link to that, your new website, in the show notes, of course. But let's kind of go back to the artist. Now, I know that you have a background as an artist. You're all about helping artists genuinely, and you help them kind of get the most from their situation with rights, because they are, you know, creating these beautiful works of music. And, you know, part of your battle and part of what you do magnificently for artists is really help them get the most long-term benefit from the work that they create. So talk to us a bit about your approach to rights and what you recommend for artists in terms of that long-term view of their rights, of their creative work they're doing.
I mean, I don't think I'm in a position to be telling artists or writers that they shouldn't sell their rights. It's not for me to say what people should do. But for me personally, I like the idea that you can partner with and work with creative people without having to get them to hand over control of their assets, basically. But, you know, at the same time, it's worth saying that you know, as much as there are lots of DIY platforms on both the recording and the publishing side, it's actually difficult to understand the nuances of copyright law around the world and all these different types of rights. Neighboring rights is a great example where even people who, you know, have been in the music industry for a long time don't really quite understand what that means. And that's not casting aspersions at those people. It's just that it is a complicated landscape. And it's a complicated landscape because it's a patchwork of different laws and systems that have been built up over time with certain controlling parties, you know, having a fairly loud voice in those discussions. So what you end up with is something where, you know, if you look from outside the music industry or look from outside of any understanding of copyright law, you sort of think, well, this should be an easy problem to solve. And lots of technological people come in and think, well, we just, you know, blockchain's going to answer that, and, you know, or whatever it might be. And I think that's a problem for artists and writers, because actually they're not sure whether they're getting paid everything that they should be. And in my experience, most people aren't. So finding the people that do know about that, who can help you to make sure that you're getting paid everything that you should be without making you sign a contract to sign away everything, is a challenge, to be honest. And so I think your question was, you know, what advice would I have? And honestly, my advice would be to, even if it's, and I say this because I don't think it's boring, but a lot of artists would tell me that, oh, this write stuff is boring, and I switch off. And yeah, you know, even managers, very successful acts, have told me, oh, I just, you know, just glaze over after the first thing. And so, but it is in your interest to try to understand it. And so actually, there's, let me give a plug for a couple of resources that I think are super, super helpful. One is that the UK Intellectual Property Office, together with PRS, put together the Get Paid Guide. You can find it, I think it's getpaidguide.com, but it might be .co.uk. And that basically is a guide to where all your royalties, you know, are, should be, where you get them from, where you need to sort of sign up to make sure that you're getting everything you could. That's a fantastic resource. And another thing is the World Intellectual Property Office, WIPO, have just launched about a year or so ago something called CLIP. I think that's clip.com, but again, just Google it and you'll find it. And that's a load of resources, again, into just how copyright works and how you can make sure that you're collecting everything. So I think the key is to educate yourself as much as possible and try to understand what's going on and do everything you can, and then find, you know, genuine partners and people that, that you think care, but maybe don't sign over everything.
Oh, that's sage advice. Hard won advice, I would say, from many musicians. I remember once chatting to the great Sammy Andrews, and she was saying that many artists never get an accurate handle on where their royalties are from, you know, works that they've created, until they're successful enough to sue the companies that signed them, which is a terrible thing to say. But
Nile Rodgers famously says, doesn't he, that I can't remember exactly what the quote is, but essentially he says that you have to audit your partners, because, you know, every single time he's done it, he hasn't not found lots of money, you know. And so that's a pretty pretty sad state of affairs.
Wow. The great Nile Rodgers, my goodness. If there's a voice to listen to for great music business advice, that's surely one of the best. But talk to us a bit about what it means to be an independent artist in 2024, looking out on the global landscape, because you mentioned it's quite complicated. There's neighbouring rights, there's all this stuff. You know, if you're kind of talking to an independent artist about the global landscape, what would you say?
Again, it's this patchwork of organisations, the CMOs, the collective management organizations and performing rights organizations around the world. They all work together, but the systems that they work together on are fairly antiquated. And so there is just a delay between not just the money, but also the data. And, you know, just the fact that an ISWC, which is the International Standard Work Code, which is the code that every single composition is assigned from whatever performing rights organisation you're using, the delay at the moment between requesting that and getting it assigned means that the majority of the music that is being uploaded into distro services and what have you isn't coming along with the publishing information. So then it's having to be matched at a later date. There's various different things. PRS are working on something, various other people, CSAC. But that's one of those things where that current inefficiency creates issues for people. And the other thing is that with a distribution deal, and you get your analytics and you look at Spotify for Artists or Apple for Artists and all the others, and you can see the usage that is happening for your music. The publishing share of that could be that the money coming from the territory that you're based in and that you're a member of that society is coming through 1 month. And it could be, 6 months to 2 years. That's a usage that happens in another country in the same period takes to flow. So matching up those royalties and doing that audit yourself is actually very difficult and very complicated to do, because you've actually got to be looking at a sort of 2 year period rather than, just the last couple of months.
Wow. Wow. And that would be a situation where I if I was a, performing artist with performances to do and recordings to make and all the rest, that sounds like exactly the kind of area that I'd be happy to hire somebody to come in and just figure that stuff out, because my goodness, it's complicated. But in terms of the artist getting a better handle on all of this, this is complicated. It sounds quite, there's so much detail there. What kind of resources are there out there for artists to help themselves, to get a bit more educated? Or, what would you like to see?
Well, what exists and what I would like to see are two different things. Right. But definitely the Get Paid Guide that I mentioned and Clip that I mentioned are great resources. Mm. All this information exists online. You just need to know what the right question is, and then you need to find a trusted source to listen to for the answer. And wow. Obviously that's, as we know from our general lives, the hardest thing about the internet is finding the right question and then the right source for the answer. But I think, if I can interpret your question as being, what would be, some good tips for artists and writers who are starting to have some success to make sure that they're minimizing any issues, is just to really make sure that you are registering everything yourself with your collection society, your neighboring rights society. In the UK, that would be PPL. Every country has its own one. If you want to work with a publisher, then do. There's a lot of benefits for that, certainly in terms of being able to make sure that someone with some experience is doing that globally. If you think that you've got a lot of usage of your music happening in other territories outside of your home territory, then it's particularly relevant. But I think, honestly, the number one thing would be just making sure that you do get those registrations in. Just make sure that you're signed up to the societies, that you understand that there are various different rights for the sake of anyone who might be listening to this who is in this position. Your composition rights as a writer, you definitely want to register those. If you're in America, you don't have a publisher, you also want to register yourself as a publisher, because otherwise you won't be collecting the mechanicals. The neighboring rights side of things, you want to register with PPL in the UK. In the US, in fact, that's quite different, because the way that Sound Exchange, which is the sort of American version, it's a different copyright law. So they collect different rights. So if you're a US citizen, you definitely want to be a member of Sound Exchange, but you might also want to consider a neighboring rights solution outside of that to collect everything outside of the US. And then, of course, your distribution, which is the bit that most artists don't forget about, because that's the bit that they sort of see, I put it up and then a bit later I get paid something.
Yeah. Fantastic. This is like a masterclass in what you need to do to make sure that those revenue streams as an artist find their way back to you. Because, like you said, with the US scenario, if you don't set up a publisher or you're not signed to a publisher, you're not going to get those royalties. That's some, hashtag TIL. I did not know that. That's just fascinating. We're living in a very fast moving technological age. Talk to us a bit about the role of technology in empowering artists, so that could be on the creative side, it could be on the business side. I mean, what are you seeing from your perspective?
Well, it'd be the only podcast about the music industry that doesn't mention AI if I don't mention it, so I will.
Yes, thank you.
It's a hot topic, as we're all aware, and let's focus it just on the tools bit that you mentioned. Obviously, there's the creation tools, which, I think there's been a lot of chat about, but I think it's worth highlighting that some of these problems in terms of auditing catalogs and massive data and all that sort of stuff, AI as a tool is likely to really help with that. So the back office side of things, I think it's hugely advantageous, but as a general topic, very, very, very complicated. So we won't go too much into that.
We won't open that can of worms altogether.
Yes. Exactly. But, you know, in terms of useful AI tools, like even things like Canva for creating flyers and artwork and stuff like that, and the AI tools that are built into there, that's, you know, super, super useful. There's all sorts of marketing and sort of digital ad help and stuff, and different tools that do that, and different parts for audience targeting and all sorts of different things. Before AI was the big hot topic, obviously the big hot topic was blockchain. There's something that I've been very interested in since 2016, 2017, and at a certain point, you know, had high hopes that it was going to really make a difference. I think the interesting thing about that is that we've ended up with the people that were huge blockchain advocates, almost the people that are, and the people that are doing well in that space, are people that are kind of operating outside of the traditional music industry. So I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's sort of too early to say, but it does feel like it's a separate ecosystem rather than necessarily improving the main ecosystem. So it'd be interesting to see how that develops, you know. But the NFT craze of a couple of years ago, personally, I think that like access tokens rather than JPEGs is probably something that we're going to see being used a lot more. Fan clubs and sort of the POAP thing of being in a place at a certain time, being able to prove it. You know, those things I think are very interesting. Royalty tracking, things like that can all be potentially used. I think it's probably also, when talking about technology, worth talking about some of the sort of concerning things or worrying things as well as the benefits. And, you know, we've all, you know, just moved onto social media, and that's where, you know, most artists are trying to build up their communities and trying to engage their, you know, there's a lot of talk of super fans at the moment. And I think that's great, but we end up potentially in a situation where, you know, if everyone's spending all of their marketing budget as an independent artist on Facebook and Instagram adverts, or, you know, and the others, but the majority of it there, we just end up in this, everyone's trying to recreate the same thing. You see that, you know, TikTok obviously has been huge for the last few years, and now every single emerging artist is basically just doing cover, or trying to do some cover versions on their TikTok to just try and get it to. So you see this sort of echo chamber of trends, which, you know, I think if you look back at the history of popular music, you see that it's the people that buck those trends that end up having the real success, you know? So, yes, you've got to know what's going on. You've got to be in front of where the people are. But I think, you know, the thing about music and any sort of creative endeavor is it is about doing something a bit different and cutting through the noise and using inspiration and being creative, you know? So we've got to think of all of these technologies, I think, as tools, and then creative people have got to use those tools in order to add something to the world that is, you know, not just another cover of a song or another love song or, you know, something interesting and new and exciting.
Yeah, well said. I mean, we actually had Josh Harmon on the podcast about a month ago, I'd say, and he's a just really interesting young guy, and he does these kind of Foley videos where he'll sit in front of a camera and he'll recreate the Foley sounds from an old, like, classic Tex Avery cartoon or something like this by using household objects, and he does it in real time, and he has guests on like Joe Jonas and Jason Derulo, I think, was on, you know, real kind of high-level stars. Cool. And he has something like close to 20 million followers across the different social media platforms. But interestingly, he says he doesn't really go in it that much. He just spends a long time working on his craft and making these live, authentic moments that then connect with people. But he doesn't really, you know, look at what's trending or look at the latest, you know, templates to use. He just tries and makes something good because he says it's better for his mental health. Not to get involved in that kind of numbers game of chasing the numbers. And also, it's kind of more sustainable, focusing on the art and making something of long-term value. And people love it. It was a really fascinating chat. And he's a young guy who's got to the heart of what it means to be on this digital hamster wheel, or what it means to make authentic content. So you're actually building a sustainable career.
Well, that's that you just said by the two things that I think are the most important thing, the two words, authenticity, No. And sustainability.
Yeah.
And I think if I had to define like what it is that I care about, what it is that I'm trying to achieve with what I'm doing, it's about helping people to build sustainable careers. It's not about, you know, how do we have a hit with this song? I mean, obviously, any client I work with would love to have a hit, and I'd be very happy if we had them. But
yeah,
it's not about that. It's about how do you get to wake up in the morning and enjoy what you do, and then that earns you enough money to be able to wake up the next morning and carry on doing something that you love. And it sounds like that's what Josh is doing. And, you know, that authenticity of finding something that you love and that passion coming through and that, you know, that's your uniqueness. And so that's what everybody, whether you're an artist or not, I think should be focusing on, is just, you know, who am I? What makes me different from everyone else? What am I interested in that, you know, not what am I interested in that other people might be interested in? No, it's what am I interested in that I just want to do? You know, so when I'm looking for an artist to work with, what I'm mostly interested in is, would these people do it even if they weren't getting paid? You know, like, it's like, do they have to do it? Because I'm sure you've had similar conversations, but, you know, I get a lot of people telling me that their nephew or their son or daughter or whatever wants a career in the music industry. Have I got any advice? And honestly, my advice is always, is there something else that you like doing that can make money? Because then you can enjoy just making music and being creative and not try to pay your rent, because you take a lot of the fun out of it doing that. So if you have to do it, if you just, you know, it's just, you're just going to do it anyway, that's the point when it's worth sort of, you know, seeing what you can build.
Yeah, indeed. There was that great quote, I think it was from Quincy Jones, RIP, who said something along the lines of, focus on yourself first and who you are and be authentic, and then the music will follow. And in 2024 and beyond, if you're an independent artist, you're plugging into the right tools and arming yourself with the right knowledge, the right education, then a sustainable career should follow as well. So that was fantastic. That was a masterclass in having a sustainable and authentic career as an independent artist in 2024. So Andy, before we wrap up, I have one very important question for you. It's a question that we ask all of our VIP guests on the Audio Talks podcast, and this is to choose a track for our Tidal playlist.
Right. Well, it's so hard, isn't it? It's like, you know, yes. I don't even get Desert Island Disc of a load of them. I also feel like I should have picked an independent artist here, but I'm not going to. I'm going to pick something that I was listening to this morning because it's just such a great track. So Yvonne Elliman, Uphill Peace of Mind.
Phenomenal. Okay. And how long have you been in love with this particular track?
Oh, many, many years. I can't remember what compilation it was originally on that I found probably 20 years ago. And then I found this vinyl record. Where was I? In the Malt House in Hythe in Kent about a couple of months ago. I found a little record shop in the top floor that was just full of, well, not great records, and I found this in the middle of them all. So I was very happy.
Oh my goodness. I love that story. And it's, you know, it's funny. We've had many episodes about vinyl. We had the CEO of Vinyl Me Please on the pod.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Great guy, Cameron Schaefer. And we talked about this idea of the artifact of the vinyl record and what it means. And, you know, most people can remember exactly where they got each vinyl record. So it's kind of different emotional journey to the streaming services, wonderful as they are. So that's brilliant. You do have the original vinyl here, and we are adding it to the Tidal playlist. Thank you. And my own contribution this time is going to be a cover version of The Flaming Lips' Do You Realize by the great Willie Nelson, only because I just love it. And it's a comforting, wonderful piece of music. So thank you so much for joining us on the Audio Talks podcast, Andy Robinson.
Been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you're enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps new listeners to get to know about the music MVPs we speak to in every single episode, like Andy. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more magnificent Audio Talks. See you next time.